We're going to hear from Gerard Brody. Gerard's the Director of Policy and Campaigns with the Consumer Action Law Centre. Consumer Action is an independent, campaign-focused consumer policy and legal organisation. Prior to this role, Gerard was a Senior Manager Financial Inclusion with the Brotherhood of St Lawrence, and Gerard oversaw the Brotherhood's recent report about improving access to home contents and vehicle insurance for low-income Australians. So Gerard's presenting the consumer perspective to John's paper.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you to the Institute of Actuaries for the invitation to come and speak today. I should say at the outset that my presentation here today is as my views and the views of Consumer Action, but not necessarily the views of all the consumer organisations and consumer representatives. We're all discussing these issues. They are very important issues to many consumer organisations, but they're their early views. So just an overview of what I'll cover this morning. I just want to touch on what we see as the market failure in flood insurance, and probably have a different view to the one expressed by Rob just then. Look at some of the options in the panels in issues paper. I want to talk a bit about non-insurance and under-insurance, and also contents insurance, and draw some of the findings of the research from the recent Brotherhood of St Lawrence report. And then finalise with some comments around claims handling and disputes, which are also being considered by the panel. So on market failure, I've got some statistics up there. I'm not 100% certain that they're exact, and the numbers do seem to change from time to time, and people would put different slants on them. I guess that we see a couple of different types of market failures emanating from the experiences this year with the floods in Queensland and the cyclone events. Firstly, there is the problem of the flood definition. As stated by the Treasury consultation paper into that issue, the confusion about the definition for many consumers makes product comparison difficult and does lead to underinsurance for flood risk. And we're very pleased that there has been movement on that issue, and there is general agreement around a definition for flood. But that's only one type of market failure. These statistics really make it clear that many people are underinsured for flood risk and have made a claim because perhaps they thought they were covered, but they weren't. And that's a different type of market failure. And the third type of market failure is precisely the primary proposal in the issues paper is aiming to deal with, and that's the affordability question, the cost of the private insurers providing flood cover in high-risk areas. So to the options that are talked about in the issues paper, our view at the moment is that the automatic flood cover is probably the preferred option. The issues paper acknowledges that a competitive market to cover flood insurance in those high-risk areas is unlikely to exist for a couple of reasons. Obviously, affordability, which has been described by John this morning, but also there can be barriers to entry. There can be difficulties in smaller insurers perhaps being able to develop the products or mapping the risk in terms of being accessed to flood mapping data and making those policies being available for consumers. I guess the main point I wanted to make here is that the model must ensure consumers have access to affordable flood cover. We do see benefits in the pool arrangements described in the issues paper. And I guess there's three points there that I just want to touch on. It is really important to provide the right incentives, as described by John this morning, so that insurers are offering insurance at an affordable basis where the market allows for this. But there is the intervention required to ensure that there is affordable access to everyone. We'd agree, secondly, that risk mitigation should be promoted in any development of this model. And thirdly, I think for consumer confidence in the pool arrangements, the issues of governance really need to be considered and to facilitate consumer input into the operation of how that pool model might work. I would make the point that one of the reasons we do prefer the automatic flood cover is the acknowledging the community benefit from broader insurance coverage. In absence of insurance, there are costs of repairing and rebuilding that is borne by the broader community. And also there's the significant distress and harm caused by the ongoing delays and disputes. Just to make a couple of points around the opt-out model, and I know that's one that's being proposed by the issues paper. John mentioned the assumption that the opt-out matter proceeds on the basis that a consumer would have made an informed choice to opt out. Our concern is that whether that happens in practice or not really depends on how that opt-out system works and how that's presented to a consumer. One lesson from consumer policy is the power of defaults. We've learned a lot about how default options work in terms of when offers or proposals are given to consumers. And consumers who are inert, unlikely to really consider all the options in front of them, will just take that default option. And so that defaults should facilitate the best outcome for those consumers and the community more broadly. An example of that, of course, most recently is in relation to superannuation and the MySuper proposals that were proposed by the Cooper Review. Finally, I would say that the paper has obviously been a lot of thought gone into it in the proposals developed, but we also need to just consider the schemes that operate internationally and government-led schemes such as the ones that operate in New Zealand for earthquake insurance. Touching on underinsurance, I would say up front that underinsurance is a different issue to non-insurance, and I think this is explained quite clearly in the issues paper. The issues paper, but also other reviews after disaster insurance events, and I'm thinking particularly about ASIC's report after the Canberra bushfires, did identify that standard home building policies in Australia do generally place the burden of estimating rebuilding costs on the consumer, which is an intrinsically difficult task and does require technical knowledge. In fact, we know that many homeowners rely upon the telephone advice or the website calculators provided by their insurer to establish the sum insured. And as such, the insurer effectively determines the sum insured, but the burden of this is wrongly fallen upon the consumer. And ASIC noted then that many of these homeowners were subsequently found to be underinsured, and that was our experience again after the Victorian bushfires. And I've just got one example from our colleagues who assisted through the bushfire legal help project that was established by Victorian Legal Aid. A consumer did purchase a small cottage in the Flowerdale area shortly before the bushfires. She had not previously owned a home or purchased building insurance. She nominated building insurance cover of $50,000 and there was access to the taped telephone transaction. And the tape revealed that she had no idea how to assess the cost of rebuilding and also suggested that the telephone underwriter was aware that $50,000 was likely to be less than would be required to rebuild. Advice was provided by the telephone underwriter on the sum required for public liability, but no advice was given regarding the inadequate sum insured for rebuilding. I'd also make the point that that's mentioned in the issues paper from the review that if there was a move to more total replacement policies rather than sum insured policies, the increase in premiums might be less than 5%. We're very pleased that the issues paper and the panel is looking at the issue of non-insurance and particularly how they affect lower income households, especially tenants. And here the issue of contents is very important. For low income households, the irony is that they're probably the ones who most need insurance, but yet have the least access to it. For them, losses can cause great hardship, even if it's just household furniture or white goods, but they're very difficult to replace for lower income earners. We're seeing more and more the governments have a asset building as a key public policy priority, and that's about helping people reduce their vulnerability, particularly those who are socially or financially excluded. Asset building priorities are going to be undermined if assets are unprotected. With the research from the Brotherhood of St Lawrence, one of the particular drivers for that research was in relation to the small loans program that's operated by the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood lends small amounts of money, up to $5,000, with the ANZ, in partnership with the ANZ, and many of those loans are for a second-hand vehicle to help people access employment, ferry their family around, and ensure that they are connected to society. For many of those people, insurance, despite being purchasing a vehicle, insurance really wasn't an option for them. There wasn't the right product there out in the marketplace. And for the Brotherhood, I know that we from time to time had issues when a car was written off, but they still had a loan repaid, a debt that was owing. And we really questioned ourselves, was that responsible lending? And I think that picks up on some of the points that John made earlier about the role of lenders in these issues as well. The research did find that there was high levels of non-insurance amongst low-income earners. Only 21% of the Brotherhood clients surveyed in the research had contents insurance. And 26% of the Brotherhood clients reported owning a car but holding no vehicle insurance at all. There was a couple of... The main drivers for these problems was an inability to understand the insurance product offerings, as well as problems with payment mechanisms. They were the particularly key problems on the consumer side. The research also interviewed some insurers and to understand some of the barriers for insurers and prevent in developing more targeted or more appropriate products. And many of those, one of the main ones that came out from those discussions was a perceived regulatory barrier to developing those sort of products. The report outlines that many of those regulatory barriers were probably more perceived rather than real, and through discussions with the regulator, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, there was a real willingness to work with the industry to overcome some of those issues. The recommendations from the Brotherhood research, one of the primary ones really were around payment mechanisms. And although the total sum of the premium was an important aspect of affordability, being able to make those premium payments in an easy and simple way was equally important. So the recommendation was insurers should accept fortnightly payments and payments through the CentrePay system, which is Centrelink's direct debit facility. That really accords with the way in which low-income people budget on a fortnightly basis and is used in a range of other essential services. The report also looks at insurance with rent schemes, which are operated internationally, and makes the recommendation that social and community housing landlords should work with insurers to develop those sort of schemes. The report recommended that insurers develop products designed specifically to meet the needs of low-income Australians, and that more should be done with the community finance providers, the small loan programs, so that those programs are offering more information and are discussing insurance alternatives with their clients. And the last recommendation was really that the industry, the governments, housing providers and the community sector should all work together to raise awareness of the dangers of being underinsured or non-insured. Finally, I just want to touch on a couple of issues related to claims handling and disputes, and particularly point to the point about the low numbers of accessing dispute resolution. So if we go back to the statistics before, out of 15% of claims refused, only 1.2% of those claims are referred to dispute resolution, and my understanding is that 60% of those is with internal dispute resolution and only 40% are with the Financial Ombudsman Service. So the question is, what's preventing people from accessing their rights around dispute resolution? Anecdotally, consumer representatives hear that there are high levels of withdrawn claims. And we acknowledge that insurance disputes are very complex as well, and that's one of the difficulties that consumers face, that without advice and assistance, they're more likely to become fatigued with their dispute and just leave it and give up rather than pursue their rights through the Financial Ombudsman Service. We were very pleased with the funding support that went to the community sector and legal aid agencies to help them assist consumers with disputes during the recent Queensland floods. But really more needs to be got done there, and needs to be ongoing support to build build expertise within those sectors about how to assist consumers with insurance disputes. There was also the issue of making the Financial Ombudsman Service more accessible and its need to be on the ground after disputes. And that was obviously done through public forums with the Insurance Council, etc. But we would probably argue that more needs to be done and they need to be there for a longer period of time to be really accessible in local capital cities. There was some talk today that there has been, you know, reasonably quick responses from the insurance industry to the disputes, and I think that's true. And we acknowledge the efforts the insurance industry have gone to. But for some, these issues do drag on. And there are efforts being made around those timeframes, including amendments to the insurance code of practice around timeframes to finalise claims and finalise disputes. But we wonder whether more can be done, and in our in the joint consumer submission to the Treasury consultation paper most recently, we raised this issue on an Australian standard of claims handling and whether that's something that might be need to be investigated further. The regulation that exists at the moment around these areas really are, so that's the Insurance Code of Practice, but also the ASIC regulatory guides, around dispute resolution. They are more focused on dispute resolution and complaints handling rather than claims handling. And consequently, they don't necessarily protect consumers from unfair claims handling and assessment practices. And numbers have been identified by consumer reps, including misinformation about a consumer's right to lodge a claim, failure to process claims without delay, poor practices with regard to the collection and use of evidence, such as technical evidence from hydrologists, failure to provide a refusal of claims without delay, including proper reasons for the refusals, and failure to adequately inform consumers of their rights to take their complaint to dispute resolution, IDR and EDR. And we just put out the question to the industry whether this is one method to improve claims handling across the sector that might be led by the industry through an Australian standard on claims handling. I'll leave it there.